are screaming now. Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, a little announcement before we begin today's show, and that is next week's show, we're going to have eyewitnesses to what's going on in the French elections. We had a show on that earlier in the year as a preview, but we got a we're going to have another show next Friday, the 28th, on that after the first round of French elections. Why are those elections important? Well, we'll talk about that with our guests who will be here next week. Okay, this week the show is related to the topic, but focused here on the U.S. The topic is America is in crisis. We all know that. What can we do? Right? We know the dimensions of the problem. We've known it for quite some time. I mean, you got to be blind and deaf not to know what's going on in this country, economically and politically. All right, what are those dimensions? Very briefly, let me just run down a short list here, because the show is, what do we do about it? You know, we have so much talk and so many intellectuals and liberals and others writing about different aspects of the crisis going on here in this country. But they all shy away from what do we do about it? You know, no one wants to step on the power elite's shoes here, you know, in regular quarters of the political elite in this country. Huh? What can we do about it is the question. You know, I'm tired of reading books by liberal economists that talk about income inequality. They all write and rewrite each other's books, but then at the end, what do they say? They don't say anything about what to do about it. Oh, you know, we got to reform this or this tax system, one, this, that, whatever. You know, well, we need more minimum wage. Okay, we need all that, but that's not going to change anything. All right, what are the dimensions of the problem? Let me just give my two cents here and then talk with our guest, a longtime union activist in the CWA and now a community activist for some time in Richmond, California. His name is Steve Early, who has a new book out called Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of American City. Very important book on what can be done and how it was done in a particular local city against great odds. You know, coming back from the abyss, bringing the city back from the abyss by local political independent organizing. It was successful, is successful. It's a case study of how it might be done. Okay, the dimensions of the problem? Well, we know inequality is running amok, don't we? Income inequality. The unions have been virtually destroyed in this country. They're just hanging on by a thread. Barely 6% of the private sector is unionized now, and the public sector, teachers and everyone, are under big attack, being rolled back. No real increases in wages adjusted for inflation for over 30 years. Our pension system has been privatized. You know, we run around with 401ks now instead of real pensions, 401ks. You know what the average amount people have in a 401k account? $18,000. That's it. That's all they got. And a lot of them are withdrawing it early because their wages are insufficient. You know, 401ks destroyed the pension system. Grandma and grandpa, no savings for 8 years now with zero interest rates by the Fed. Now, banks are getting filthy rich, investors getting free money, but grandma and grandpa, nothing. Over $1 trillion in lost savings account interest for retirees. A tax on Medicare, Social Security going on, minimum wages falling further behind. Privatization of the health insurance system? Yeah, that's what Obamacare is. George Bush couldn't do it with his health savings account, so Obama has done it with Obamacare. 8 years of low-paid service job creation, free trade devastating millions of jobs, tax cuts for corporations to replace workers with automation and robots, contingent work, part-time temp contract, gig work. You know, where now they don't even, businesses and managers don't even provide the tools for the job. You got to provide them. That's what gig work is. They don't have to invest in equipment. They're going to use yours. That's what gig work is all about. Let me make a comment about gig work. You know what gig work reminds me of? This is the corporate hiring hall. It used to be that unions had power and some influence because they had hiring halls. They had control of the job. You had to go to the union and dispatch to the job. You got your job through the union. Well, what is gig except corporate hiring halls in the ether, in the internet, right? They control the job. They tell you where to go. It's like a shape-up, you know. They used to call it the shape-up. You go down to the docks, and the boss would pick who they want. Yeah. Well, the gig works the same thing. It's a corporate hiring hall. How about debt, student debt, over $1.4 trillion, credit card debt over $1 trillion, auto debt over $1 trillion, rents unaffordable, home prices going through the roof if you want to buy because of foreign investors and shadow banks like BlackRock. 3 million H-1Bs have come into this country taking the high-paying jobs. We talked about that last week, the H-1B, right? Oh, Trump was going to do something about that. He's done nothing. He just announced something, and it was nothing. 38% of millennials now live at home with their parents because they can't afford even an apartment. Police repression and assault on the rise, militarization of the police forces, 15 years of perpetual wars in the Middle East, over $5 trillion with no end in sight, $1 trillion a year defense and war budget, $10 trillion in tax cuts for investors and corporations since George W. Bush, yeah, and Obama, $6 trillion of that, and now Trump wants another $6 trillion. Price gouging by Big Pharma, killing thousands now. Slow-rolling destruction of public education, money controlling more and more of the political system, corporate profits have more than doubled since the recession, stock markets have tripled, and over $5 trillion has been redistributed by businesses to their shareholders in stock buybacks and dividend payouts. Well, this is the dimension of the problem. We all know one or more of these things, right? The problem now is, what do we do about it? Let's stop just talking about the dimension of it, and let's talk about how do we do something about it. How do we organize? The solution should be pretty clear by now that falling behind populist presidential candidates is a dead end. We had the left populism of Barack Obama, lied to us, didn't achieve a damn thing. And now we got the mirror image of that, of Donald Trump, right populism. Right? And what's he doing? He's backtracking so fast he's stumbling over himself. Retreating on all these things, right populist proposals he made during the election now, and he's falling in line with the bureaucracy and the political elites, and they love him now. The solution is not through either wing of the corporate party of America, in my view. I mean, look what the Democratic elite did to Sanders. Boy, they sabotaged him, didn't they? And now they're whipping Trump in line, if he ever was out of line. Right? This is not news. We know all this. The question is, what can be done? Do we keep voting for professional liars of either wing of the corporate party of America? Do we drop out and discuss? Disgust and cynical disillusion, or do we fight back? Well, I think the only alternative is the latter. We got to fight back, but the lesson is it has to be independently. The lesson so adequately described in Steve's book, again, Refinery Town, is that it can be done. It has been done in Richmond, California. Reading this book, though, you know, the lessons I take from it is that it can be and must be done independently of the two parties, right? And it must start locally. must start locally. And you don't need to rely on left liberal intellectuals to lead or tell us what to do with some top-down program and proposals. The people can do it themselves from the bottom up. That's another lesson, I think, from Refinery Town. The other lesson, I think, is it requires organizational effort. Spontaneous rebellions don't accomplish a thing. They just dissipate. You know, the elites will wait you out and pick off your leaders, and everything will dissipate. We've seen this time and time again in the country, right, where you have these rebellions from below, you know, whether it's Occupy or whether it's Black Lives Matter or whatever, and they dissipate. They don't, because there's no organization to it. And the other lesson, I think, is that in Richmond is it requires electoral as well as non-electoral action. And the answer is not identity politics. The answer is some broad-based community action, class-based issues, real issues, many of which I just listed here at the beginning. You know, I just went down a short list of all the problems. We have the issues. The question is, how do we organize around those issues? Well, I think Steve's book here, Refinery Town Again, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City, is something everybody should read, because it's got to start at the local level. It's got to start at the grassroots. It's got to be independent, and it's got to be electoral and non-electoral, and it's got to have organization. You can't do anything without organization. Spontaneous rebellions and identity politics are a dead end. Okay, that's the lessons I see from this book, but I'm going to let Steve fill out the details for us and tell us you know, his experience, because he was involved in this. You know, a union guy with union knowledge and background and skills and so forth was part of this coalition here in Richmond, California, that took back the city that was dominated, controlled by Big Oil, Chevron Corporation, who fought them tooth and nail with money and all kind of dirty tricks all along the way, and, of course, is still fighting. So the fight goes on in Richmond, as it will everywhere else. One thing I learned in the labor movement for many years is that corporations management never gives up. They never give up. You may get a temporary gain or leading hand. They bide their time. They prepare. They come back at you again and again and again. So organizing and resisting is a perpetual effort here, community-wise and so forth. But the way is to build locally, build organization locally, win local victories, do it independently, because you'll get co-opted by the other parties if you bring them into the mix. But it can be done. It has been done in Richmond. So, Steve, you there with us?
I am, Jack. Thanks for having me back on the show.
Okay. Steve, I really want you to tell our listeners here how this was actually done. Can you start with what was the condition here in Richmond, this refinery town, oil refinery town, in California, in the Bay Area, before people began organizing? And then tell us how the organization came together. But tell us first, what were these conditions? They were abysmal. I mean, I remember Richmond was considered the pits of the Bay Area here, with you know, terrible conditions and terrible violence. You know, people who are in poverty get desperate and resort to whatever means to survive. You know, you had terrible violence. It was called Murder City, California, for a while. But tell us, describe the conditions on the eve of the effort of this Richmond Alliance political formation.
Well, you're absolutely right, Jack. 15 to 20 years ago, Richmond had a very different reputation regionally than it does today. Today, it's a widely hailed progressive city. Back Two decades ago, as you note, it was known for its three C's, crime, corruption, and Chevron. Crime was the street crime you referenced, a lot of gun violence, a lot of gang activity, a lot of drug trafficking, and a horrendously high homicide rate. Corruption, you know, in City Hall, totally dysfunctional city managers who at one point put the city close to bankruptcy. And then, of course, more than a century of problems with Chevron, previously known as Standard Oil, major oil company, biggest employer in town, biggest taxpayer, but also the biggest polluter of the air, water, and local politics, long dominant in municipal affairs. So, you know, it was a city where there was cronyism, financial mismanagement, abuse of police, joblessness, substandard housing, a real mess. And as a result, a 80% non-white population of a city of about 110,000 really suffered in many ways from bad and dysfunctional local government. And those were the circumstances that 14 years ago led a group of activists to come together and form the Richmond Progressive Alliance.
Okay, so 14 years ago, that would put it, 2002.
Correct. And over a two-year period, a group of activists that include members of the California Green Party, dissident Latino and African-American Democrats, socialists of varying stripes, and independent voters, some people who are still part of the California Peace and Freedom Party, came together, developed an ambitious 10 or 12-point program for municipal reform, created an organization that today has a dues-paying membership of 300 to 400, runs candidates, but also, and perhaps more importantly, has a year-round multi-issue organizing program. It doesn't just pop up at election time. And since 2004, when progressives in Richmond started running for local office, RPA candidates have won 10 out of 16 municipal races, I think is a track record that's probably one of the best at this level of government anywhere in the country. And last fall, two first-time RPA candidates, Melvin Willis and Ben Choi, placed first and second in a field of nine running for the city council. All of their opponents were corporate-backed Democrats of one sort or another. And with those latest victories, we now have a five-member progressive supermajority on a city council of seven. And also on the ballot last year was rent control, adopted by the voters by a 2-to-1 margin, a tremendous victory for the progressive movement and for affordable housing. It rolled back rents to 200 to levels of a year before, created a rent board to adjudicate landlord-tenant disputes. Landlords can no longer evict tenants in Richmond without just cause, and future rent hikes have to be tied to the overall cost of living increases. So a great victory around an important economic issue affecting thousands of poor and working-class residents of this city who rent their housing.
You referred to RPA. That's the name of the organization.
Correct, the Richmond Progressive
Party, or whatever you want to call it, right? That's Richmond Progressive Alliance, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Hey, before we move on, is there a website or something where people can check out, RPA and whatever and see what their program is?
They can. It's, if you just Google Richmond Progressive Alliance, it's a very good website with a history of the organization, description of its structure, copy of its bylaws, and updates on its current activities and profiles of the five fine folks that it has elected to the city council. And I should note that four of them are people of color, and one of the progressive candidates elected last fall is the youngest city councilor in the city's history, 26-year-old African-American Melvin Willis, who's works for the Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment, community group here, and was the leading advocate of rent control. So this is... These are not your usual politicians. These are people who come out of the labor movement, the environmental movement, the housing rights and tenants movement. And when they get elected to municipal office in Richmond, they use their city positions to help rally the folks that elected them, that they continue to build the constituent groups that are part of the labor community coalition that is the Richmond Progressive Alliance. And so you have a very different and dynamic relationship between people on the inside of city government and people on the outside, you know, still engaged in direct action, resistance to Trump, organizing all kinds of protests and movement activity.
You mentioned a 10-point program. Can you briefly summarize what that program is?
Sure. When it was developed in 2003, 2004 at a well-attended citywide people's convention or people's assembly, there was a lot of concern about hiring better help, you know, effective and competent city manager and a new police chief. Police accountability was a major issue. Richmond historically did not have a police force that was representative of the majority-minority community that it was policing. There had been a number of incidents in which Latinos had been beaten up and harassed, and the city had cops who were shooting people, and it was costing the city a lot of money in civil rights suits and litigation. So police reform, housing affordability, you know, it took 12 years to get rent control, but that was on the agenda from the very beginning, protecting the environment and slowing global warming as best you can do at the local level through supporting tighter safety regulation of local employers like Chevron, raising local labor standards. It took a number of years to boost the local minimum wage, but that was accomplished. Getting corporations, including Chevron, in the city to pay their fair share of taxes, reducing the influence of big money in politics, and that was done through enacting a system of public matching funds for candidates for local office, and making local economic development projects benefit everyone. So if somebody is coming in and building market-rate housing, that's going to generate funds to build affordable housing, to keep the current class and racial mix of the city, rather than have it be the next subject of Bay Area gentrification and displacement of poor and working class people, the trend that we've seen in San Francisco and now Oakland, and headed Richmond's way if we hadn't enacted rent control last fall.
Okay, so affordable housing was an issue. Money in politics was an issue and part of your program. Basic labor standards, raising minimum wage, environmental safety, of course, you know, with a big refinery there, that's an issue. Police accountability. I mean, these sound like real bread and butter issues that can unite people across mere identity issues.
Very definitely. And, you know, not every issue that has been raised here has been a winning one. As I describe in the book, in 2012, there was a very well-intentioned effort to introduce a penny-per-ounce tax on sugary drinks. Richmond was one of the first cities to try to enact a soda tax. It was supported by local progressives as a public health measure. Two candidates running that year were very closely associated with the soda tax referendum, but it was badly defeated by a 2-to-1 margin. There was a huge amount of soda industry spending against it, and it was defeated because it was depicted as a regressive tax on poor and working class people. There was a lot of racial and class tension introduced into the election that year, and it was a you know, well-intentioned public policy initiative that was political poison. Ironically, since then, other cities, neighboring cities, San Francisco, Oakland, Berkeley, even Philadelphia on the East Coast have all adopted measures like this to increase revenue and to provide more money for public health and sports and recreation and youth sports programs. But in Richmond, that was definitely an effort that did not help build the progressive movement in the way that, for example, rent control did when that was on the ballot last fall.
Was the failure of the soda tax maybe because the monies weren't earmarked for some progressive alternative use? Or I mean,
yeah, that's one of the challenges you face under California law for a measure like that, a tax measure, to be specifically earmarked. It has to be approved by a two-thirds vote. So this was put on the ballot as a simple majority question. People had to trust City Hall to allocate the $2 or $3 million that would have been raised annually to the programs that it was designed to support. And the industry counter campaign part of it was aimed at convincing people that the money would go to fill potholes instead, or pay City Hall salaries or pensions or benefits. The idea was that this was not going to be a dedicated revenue stream. But the bigger issue was that big business came in. They created an AstroTurf campaign that's really a model for what the oil industry, the energy industry, is doing in minority communities today around the issue of climate change measures. And they're very effective at depicting any of these kinds of reforms as something that's going to pick the pockets of people who can, you know, least afford higher taxes, higher gas prices, or higher soda prices. So I think the lessons of that campaign are very important because the game plan of the soda industry is now being adopted by the Koch brothers and others that want to fight renewable energy initiatives and fuel conservation efforts, anything to slow global warming by convincing non-white communities that it's not in their best interest to enact these measures.
Was there any effort over the last history of the RPA to limit the money expenditures in these campaigns, either electoral or issue campaigns here by, you know, big businesses like Chevron and so forth?
Well, as you know, there's very little that we can do at the moment in the wake of the Supreme Court's decision in the Citizens United cases, which kind of opened the floodgates for unlimited corporate spending on elections and on referenda questions of all kinds at the state, local, and federal level. In California, there does have to be reporting of, to a degree, of who's behind these so-called independent expenditure committees, and it's pretty clear who's behind the committees that Chevron sets up every 2 years. Over the last three election cycles, between big oil, big soda, and last fall, the landlord lobby, about $7 to $8 million was spent trying to defeat progressive candidates and proposals like rent control and the soda tax, and elect pro-business Democrats. Now, for the most part, the progressives here were able to overcome that tidal wave of corporate money. Local public matching funds helped level the playing field a little bit, but in other places, that kind of spending would have won the day for the corporate side. I mean, you really have to build grassroots organization and election year turnout capacity. You have to build an army of hundreds of volunteers, people willing to knock on doors, talk to their neighbors, because when you can't afford the billboards and the social media ads and the TV and radio spots and the glossy mailers that fill up your mailbox at election time in Richmond, you have to get your message across in other ways through people power.
Yes, we're talking here for our listeners about the new book, Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City, with its author, Steve Early, a longtime union community activist who has participated in the resurrection of an American city against great odds, big corporate money and great odds, but nonetheless has done it and continues to do it. It's an ongoing project here in Richmond, and we're getting his inside view of how it was done, how a local city grassroots organizing by progressives and others from the bottom up can confront and actually win in these struggles against corporate-dominated, elite-dominated, corporate party-dominated politics in this country now. Can you describe to us how it all began? I mean, at some point, individual citizen outrage against the conditions and so forth had to coalesce in some initial effort here. You talked about a citywide people's assembly was the starting point. How did that come about?
Well, I think people, activists in Richmond 14, 15 years ago, came to realize the limits of their respective single-issue focused activity. There were people working on the issue of homelessness. There were people already concerned about housing affordability and wanting to propose rent control. There were people understandably concerned about police brutality. There were city employees who had been adversely affected by the incompetence of the city manager and the city council in managing the city budget. They had, jobs had been cut and services had been curtailed, so they wanted a different approach to municipal employee labor relations. So you had a range of single-issue groups and individual activists, and in a very important way, they decided, look, we're ultimately only going to make more progress on these different fronts if we come together, form a kind of broad political tent here, start running some people for office so we can have some insiders, not just outside agitators, you know, mobilizing crowds to go to the city council and banging on doors and trying to get the old guard in the city to do a few good things. And you know, people had to set aside some political differences. They had to not insist that the coalition be branded, you know, as a Green Party branch. You know, municipal elections here are nonpartisan, as they are in many cities. Politicians running for office are not identified as Democrats, Republicans, Greens, or Socialists, or anything. But the Richmond Progressive Alliance was pretty consciously built as a de facto political party, and it filled a big vacuum. Most registered voters in the city are Democrats. The opposition, you know, playing the role of the Republicans elsewhere, are corporate-backed Democrats. And over time, as more progressives have been elected, they've been able to form coalitions with some liberals on the city council to get some things done. But as I mentioned earlier, particularly for 8 years, when Richmond was the largest city in the country with a green mayor, the mayor at that time, Gail McLaughlin, used her city job as mayor, you know, as a bully pulpit to rally causes and campaigns and help people build the social and economic justice movements, environmental movements in the city that had helped elect her.
So was it Gail Laughlin who called the first People's Assembly, or did that assembly occur before she was actually the mayor?
No, she was part of that, and lots of different individuals and groups were invited to participate and provided input into the initial reform agenda. And of course, over the years, you know, other issues have come up and other causes and campaigns have been embraced. And that's, again, what really distinguishes the Richmond Progressive Alliance from other political formations that tend to pop up or function just at election time. You know, when you have a storefront office, when you're functioning as a year-round organizing center, when you have a multi-issue program, membership base, you know, there's a different kind of dynamic going into election campaigns. I mean, the other big dividing line, of course, in Richmond is that RPA candidates are corporate-free. They do not accept business donations of any type. And that really sets them aside from just about everybody else running for mayor, city council, now and in the past in the city, because you know, Democrats may often be allies on some issues, but when they take corporate money, you know, we know what the results of that are long term in terms of their policy orientation. And Richmond progressive candidates run in a way that's very different organizationally, and their refusal to accept corporate money and their reliance instead on Bernie Sanders style small donor base really distinguishes them from the rest of the field.
You mentioned earlier that the RPA is a dues membership. Can you describe what that means and why the RPA?
Well, it's not a lot of money, $12 a year, probably time for a dues increase. It's a volunteer organization and a membership organization, which is important because, you know, if you're promoting economic democracy and democratization of city government, your own group ought to have some degree of internal democracy. So members have periodic membership meetings. They can sit in on any monthly meeting of the elected steering committee. The steering committee of 25 people is elected annually by the members. It also includes organizational representatives from several community groups and unions affiliated with the RPA. And the steering committee today is a majority people of color, much younger than in the past, and slight female majority. So there's been an effort to try to make the leadership of the progressive organization in the city more reflective of the diversity of Richmond's population. And also create some space for younger people, which I think is real important. We're all familiar with how unhealthy it is in unions and in many other organizations for older activists to not get out of the way, not allow younger people to move up and play leadership roles. And RPA, in recent years in particular, done a really good job of doing that, and it's paid off at the polls.
Does the RPA have anything like bylaws or described structure? And
It does, yeah. If you go to the website, there's some simple bylaws that describe how the steering committee is elected and operates, and membership rights. I think it's, you know, this is a volunteer organization. It's not staff-dominated. It doesn't take foundation money. It's a very different model than some of the other good groups it works with. Communities for a Better Environment, for example, ACE, which I mentioned earlier, the Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment, the former ACORN. I mean, these are good groups, but they're staff-dominated, staff-run. They have full-time people. They get a lot of social change foundation money, and that has an upside and a downside. The RPA, in addition to running candidates who are corporate free, is pretty much foundation grant free, for better or worse, which means that its budget is small. It has to rely on membership dues and its own fundraising. But it also means that its priorities are set by the members of the group and reflect the needs and concerns of people in the community. They're not set by, you know, what some have called the nonprofit industrial complex.
So this dues-paying membership organization has elections every year to make sure it's accountable?
Correct, yep. We just had a big membership meeting a month or two ago to elect the new steering committee. More than 100 people participated, which should be third or fourth of the entire membership. Very good turnout, high level of enthusiasm, coming off last November 8th, exciting election victory, and the swearing in January of two more progressives on the city council. And, you know, the challenge of implementing rent control. When you pass a rollback in rents, you create a rent board, you set up this requirement that no evictions without just cause. There has to be a whole new administrative apparatus. There has to be people in a rent board who are going to be pro-tenant. So there's a lot of effort over the last couple of months making sure that implementation of the popular will in that referendum vote last fall is going to produce the results that tenants want.
I'm speaking with Steve Early, who is the author of this excellent new book called Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of American City. That's recently been published, and I really recommend everybody who's interested in what do we do about the problem to read this book, because there's a lot, by Beacon Press, by the way, just published this year, 2017, and there's a lot of lessons on how to build a grassroots continual political organization to make change at the local level as a start for larger and broader change throughout the country here, which has to be done. So anyway, continuing. Okay, so we've had new elections here. What are the new initiatives that the RPA has identified, you know, in the period ahead that are its objectives?
Well, one is participating in larger tax reform coalitions. There's a lot of limitations, as I point out in the last chapter of the book, to what progressives, leftists, greens, socialists, any kind of reformers can do at the city level. California, as you know, Jack, our local public schools here are under the control of a county board. Property taxes are not assessed locally. Big problem. It's a county function. And our biggest local taxpayer, Chevron, gets to take advantage of a huge corporate tax loophole that was created by Proposition 13 in California in 1978. Since then, there's been a huge shift in the property tax burden from commercial property owners to homeowners. Today, corporations in California are only paying about 28% of the total property tax bill. Chevron's property, if it was assessed and taxed as it was before enactment of Proposition 13, the company would be contributing $30 million more a year locally for much-needed public programs. And statewide, the state of California would be getting nearly $250 million more annually in revenue. So we need tax reform. There are some groups working on that, the Make It Fair Coalition. We need to close this big loophole for commercial property owners, particularly of the global corporations sort like Chevron. So working with other communities on tax reform issues is a major priority because the city will never be able to meet all the needs of its residents without a bigger revenue base, and its hands are tied right now in the area of property taxation.
Any other primary issues besides tax reform going forward?
Well, another, again, multi-city issue in Contra Costa County is, you know, we have a county sheriff here who's very enthusiastic, it appears, about the Trump administration. You know, locally, our city has been for more than a decade a sanctuary city. The police, you know, now and for more than 10 years have not cooperated with any kind of federal immigration law enforcement or roundups of foreign-born people in Richmond who are undocumented. But we have a county sheriff who wants to cooperate with ICE, wants to use a local detention facility to house ICE detainees, persuaded the county board of supervisors to spend millions of dollars on jail expansion. Activists in Richmond, Richmond's representative on the county board of supervisors, and the city's own elected leadership are trying to build a broader multi-city coalition to challenge this direction in law enforcement and criminal justice at the county level. Again, an example of how you can only do so many things in a single city, and you need allies in other cities and other counties and in the rest of the country, ultimately, if we're going to change politics fundamentally in the U.S.
So the RPA and the city are reaching out to other communities in similar efforts to build an RPA-like organization. Is that going on elsewhere?
Very, very definitely. In January, the newly elected Progressive Alliance Steering Committee here voted to become part of Our Revolution, which is the post-Sanders campaign political network that I think this week is going to be announcing about 200 affiliates all around the country. Our Revolution helped with fundraising for our two city council candidates last fall. 2 years ago, as I described in the book, Bernie Sanders came to Richmond and helped us raise thousands of dollars for the Progressive Alliance and its candidates in 2014 when we had a big showdown with Chevron. And We definitely think that our revolution is one way of linking up with other like-minded progressive groups in both the East Bay and other parts of California and around the country. It's really only going to succeed as a follow-up to the Sanders campaign if it's built from the bottom up and help support more forms of local organization like the Richmond Progressive Alliance, as opposed to, you know, the good work of raising funds for candidates who are endorsed and backing referenda issues, which our revolution has also been effective at.
Okay, so our revolution is a post-Sanders, this is part of his ongoing organization here?
Well, he's not directly involved in it, but it was started by his supporters. It has a Washington, D.C. staff. It endorsed about 100 candidates last fall. About 60 of them won. And, again, not all Democrats. In some of the most successful ORA-backed candidates were in Vermont. We're running under the banner of the Vermont Progressive Party. And Vermont today has an independent progressive lieutenant governor, Dave Zuckerman, protege of Bernie's, who was strongly supported by our revolution and Bernie last fall. And defeated a Republican and is now the only statewide elected official anywhere in the country who is a progressive from a third party.
So is our revolution primarily focused on candidates running for office and assisting candidates?
So far, but I think it's also been backing efforts by Bernie supporters where they want to take this route to run as delegates in Democratic Party state conventions. But it's a pretty loose, decentralized organization, and people who are less interested in working within the Democratic Party and building more independent forms of political organization like the Richmond Progressive Alliance are also welcome in the Our Revolution tent and get a lot of benefit out of it. Our two candidates last fall got email blasts to the Bernie donor list that raised $5,000 for each of them within 24 hours, and they got 900 to 1,000 new out-of-town donors. The list of 2.6 million people who gave to the Bernie Sanders campaign is a gift that keeps on giving, and you know, we're hoping that as some progressives in Richmond decide to move up and maybe run for office at the level of the state legislature or maybe statewide, they'll also get the benefit of backing from our revolution.
Do you see any concern that RPA and other such organizations may become dependent on this finance source?
Well, I don't think the amounts are large enough that there's going to be any relationship of dependency. I mean, when you're raising money for, you know, scores of candidates, the pie is split many different ways. I think, you know, what ultimately is the key to success locally is the fundraising capacity you build locally, developing a base of volunteers, people who are willing to knock on doors and phone bank, talk to their neighbors, distribute literature directly, and solicit small donations. In Richmond, as I mentioned, you know, this system of public matching funds helps you leverage that capacity if you can develop it. You know, if you at this point, you know, can raise $25,000 on your own, you get a 50% match in the city of Richmond, less generous than it used to be, but it rewards the people who have a grassroots base. And, you know, through patience and persistence, that can be developed. It's the only way, however, to, you know, wean our politics away from a dependence on big corporate donors.
So that was a measure that was successfully passed in the Richmond City Council, proposed by
Correct.
The RPA.
Yeah, and you know, it's not as generous as
that?
The public matching funds legislation that's been adopted for municipal elections in New York City, where it's a 6-to-1 match, or Portland, Oregon, another place that just enacted it. I think it's an important electoral reform that people should be focusing on more. It's not a panacea. It's not a cure-all. And nobody's going to be writing you a check if you don't do a lot of fundraising among, you know, private donors of modest means, because that's the only way you can qualify. And the candidates of the traditional sort, you know, who don't have that grassroots organizational base aren't able to take advantage of it. And, of course, the candidates that are corporate-backed don't need to take advantage of it because their donors are not limited to, you know, giving them $2,500 to run for city council. If they're backed by a corporate super PAC like Chevron's, you know, independent expenditures can be made on their behalf, totally uncoordinated, of course, you know, that can, you know, be worth hundreds of thousands of dollars that the candidate themselves, the favored candidates, don't have to raise. And so that's what we're still up against in election years where Chevron throws the full weight of its big money into politics, into local races.
How does the RPA compete in terms of communications and trying to get the word out and to the general populace and what it's doing and what needs to be?
Well, they has a very
so forth.
A good email list of, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 supporters. It has a campaign newspaper that, particularly during election years, comes out 3 or 4 times a year, the Richmond Sun. You know, it uses community meetings, and it uses the participation of individual activists who are leaders in neighborhood councils and who are appointed members of city boards and commissions. Another way that progressives have tried to influence the direction of city policy is by getting progressives onto the Housing Commission, the Planning Commission, the Rent Board, Parks and Recreation, all kinds of city bodies. I'm a member of the City Personnel Board. I hear appeals from city employee grievances. So it's not just elected officials who are volunteering time and energy to help move things in a better, more equitable direction. It's a lot of other people who are part of the volunteer base of the progressive movement.
So it sounds like there is a real organizational structure, not only within the RPA, defined clearly and ongoing beyond elections, but also your members are embedded in these local community groups, neighborhood councils, city commissions, and you have a regular way of communicating to the community, which seems to me pretty important because, you know, corporations and Chevron and so forth, they just spend the money and, you know, they buy the airtime and whatever that they need to do to get their word out.
Oh, very definitely. I mean, Chevron's, you know, gives $10, $15 million every year in philanthropic grants to all kinds of worthy local organizations, nonprofits, churches, the NAACP. Of course, you know, this buys a certain kind of loyalty and political allegiance, even if the programs themselves are worthwhile and in a better world would be tax financed. But Chevron is very media savvy. It has a community news site. It, as you indicated, spends a lot of money on advertising and is very much committed to trying to win hearts and minds in Richmond and any other place it operates.
What has been the nature of the cooperation or resistance from the Sacramento, the state level, politicians? In California, of course, it's heavily Democratic dominated. Have they been an obstacle or in any way?
Well, structurally, there are things that the legislature has done that limits the impact of municipal reforms, rent control being one. One example of that, the rent control measure that was adopted in Richmond last fall only applies to pre-1995 housing. So while that still benefits perhaps 20,000 people in Richmond living in 9 or 10,000 units, many other people are uncovered, and that's by action of the state legislature. So we do face in these so-called rebel cities the challenge of Republicans and corporate Democrats controlling state government, controlling Congress, and using government at those levels to try to restrict the ability of cities to raise the minimum wage, to introduce environmental measures of their own, to expand the scope of reforms like rent control. So we're going to be seeing more of this tug of war between cities and state government and certainly the federal government in the Trump era.
You have raised the minimum wage. You have a local minimum wage.
Yes. It was watered down. It was not 15. That was the original demand, but it goes to $13 an hour next January. And at the time it was adopted, there was not a progressive majority in the city council, and I think there's going to be an effort, so there were some carve-outs. There was a kind of delayed implementation that has been, the compromise that Fight for 15 campaigners have been forced to accept in other cities as well. There was a lot of business lobbying about raising it at all, and bringing it even to 13 an hour on the current schedule that was adopted. But an issue that's going to be revisited, I'm sure.
What would be your advice to folks in another city somewhere confronting these significant problems locally? What would be your advice on how to get started?
Well, I think looking at the relevance of this hybrid model of organization where you have a focus on electoral politics and running candidates, but you're breaking with the usual pattern of people running for office in kind of individualistic, career-advancing, entrepreneurial fashion. Progressive Alliance candidates run as part of tickets, as slates, as teams, bound together by a common platform and a rejection of corporate financing. And people understand that when they get elected, they're going to be a lot more serious than many people we elected about implementing the platform, the program that they ran on. So making electoral politics more of a collective effort, more programmatic, more principled, making it corporate free, and then tying those efforts to the year-round multi-issue organizing campaign and building a membership organization, a de facto political party, however you brand it. Be different strokes for different folks there, but I think those elements are kind of essential in really cities of any size.
How does the RPA attempt to build its membership in between elections?
Tries to use the influx of election year volunteers, which are often greater than actual dues-paying members, to get more people to sign up. It's a continual effort. It's voluntary membership. If you don't sign people up for credit card deductions, you're going to be chasing after them every 12 months for another $12. So membership, is a maintaining, high membership levels is a constant challenge. But I think just enough people being conscious of the need to talk to other people about it. Oftentimes people don't join things until they're asked to join it, just like a union campaign in an open shop situation where membership is voluntary. You've got to constantly be talking to people if they're interested in particular issues that your organization is involved in. That's an opening to encourage them to pay dues to make the organization stronger and more effective in pursuing those issues.
So it's kind of a one-on-one attempt to build the organizational membership.
Oh, yeah, very much so. And, of course, by creating a structure, bylaws, a system electing the leadership, just like in a union, that's an incentive. Only members can come to the annual membership meeting that elects the steering committee. Only members, obviously, can run for the steering committee. So that's also, an annual focus of getting people to sign up or to renew so they can participate fully in the internal democratic life of the organization. This is not the style of the Democratic Party. Who belongs to the Democratic Party? Hardly anybody. People don't pay dues to it. They, at best, may register if they are sympathetic to Democrats, but a lot of people vote for Democrats while remaining unenrolled or independent.
Okay, this is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Vision.